Welcome back to Trickle Down Socialism, where we discuss how the U.S. currently has a system of socialism for the super rich and corporations, where we try to defang the term socialism and explore how government, with just a slight tweak in priorities and a focus on social investment, could be a force for good in all of our lives.
Dan, what's going on?
Hey, aren't you that guy from the Boston Superintendent's Twitter feed?
I was on the Superintendent's Twitter feed.
You rock star.
It was pretty wild. Found out this morning from our principal that she was going to, you know, bring the new acting mayor, Boston's first black mayor, Boston's first woman mayor, by the classroom. And I just happened to be teaching Brown versus Board of Education. And I didn't know it, but Acting Mayor Jenny is a product of Edwards Middle School and a product of busing, desegregation in Boston. So she was able to share with the kids about her experience riding in a school bus to the Edwards and having rocks thrown at the bus as it entered Charlestown. Really powerful stuff. So that was cool. See money.
Yeah. What's happening, Pat?
It's good to have
What's
you back.
What's happening, Dan?
Welcome, brother.
Good to be
Patrick,
back.
We're finally talking about my favorite subject.
You tree hugger from Vermont. Yeah, we have been really neglectful. I haven't been able to find anyone.
Yeah, just so
anyone.
You know, in Vermont, when you talk about trickle down, that means you got a bucket and you tap that shit, and then you run lines through the woods, and that's called a maple farm.
Okay. Yeah, so I haven't been able to find a great expert to talk about the environment until now. So we're going to have an interview on this episode with Ali Dalsimer, who's running for Congress in Virginia's 11th. But before we get to that, I think there are a number of things that have happened recently that bear discussion here. So we got Evanstown, Illinois, has decided that they're going to make reparations happen, even though it's just slow to happen at the federal level. The city council voted to distribute $400,000 to eligible black households.
They're levying a tax on newly legalized marijuana to fund projects benefiting African Americans. That's kind of an interesting combination of progressive goals there.
Well, you look at the consequences of the drug war, and there should be reparations for that as well. You know, so it really makes sense now that you have legalized, and you actually have, you know, unfortunately, far too many corporations, white-owned corporations that are capitalizing on legalized pot. You know, it makes a lot of sense to tax those groups and give that money to descendants of slaves.
For sure, yeah. You guys have probably had the same stuff with legalization that we have around here, and that a lot of venture capitalist type firms from out of town came in to set up shop and kind of price out even the local guys and then take all the money with them. So I think it's interesting to see a city council come out so quickly and kind of lay claim to that before anybody else starts siphoning the money out of
the
community.
And so they actually did open up pot licensure in Massachusetts they gave priority to black and minority owned groups that wanted to start their own dispensaries. But unfortunately, that time period was very short. It was like a 48-hour window. But one of the members of this podcast team, who hasn't been on for a while because he's been quite busy with work, Carlos, is a part owner of a new dispensary that just opened up in Jamaica Plain that is 100% black and minority owned, woman run dispensary in JP. So we're actually hoping to set up an interview with, they have a board of this group that has curated a museum on social justice and the consequences of the war on drugs. That museum is attached to the dispensary in JP. So we're hopefully going to have a conversation with some of those folks who have curated that museum and also are kind of guiding the ship of that 100% minority-owned business that is doing, I think, what a lot of people envisioned when pot was finally legalized. Just making it legal and making it something that folks who were disproportionately punished for using or selling can finally do it above board and benefit from.
That's super cool. You know, another aspect of that that has kind of popped up here in Maine is criminal records and expungement and sealing of criminal records. This past week, there was actually a lawsuit from the Maine Press Association against the state because the state enacted a law to seal all marijuana convictions from before it was legalized. So they can't have regular records access to this stuff. And the ACLU actually ended up agreeing with the state and not with the Press Association. So I thought that was kind of an interesting split. You don't normally hear it go that way. But I think that's pretty progressive on the part of Maine to kind of sweep that stuff under the rug and let the
this
rug
cover. This could be
it
sort of
forever.
Like one of those pipe dreams, like Biden's second administration or whatever. But hearing you guys talk is making me think, like, as we move to legalize marijuana on a national level, that should be directly tied to criminal justice reforms. Between the free market selling a lot of weed, which will generate a lot of revenue, right, for the government. But if I was making the argument to a conservative, I would say, hey, there's this super bloated government program with lots of people on the rolls. It's called fucking prison. You know what I mean? Like, it's really bloated. Y'all filled it full of people for some petty ass crimes, right? Like, that's really what it is. It's like a giant, you know, and now they're paying corporations to do it, but they're still paying, right? The feds still pay the tab.
Right. No, there are some conservatives, and it's few and far between at this point, who agree with that standpoint of, you know, we have a massive prison industrial complex, and we need to trim the fat there because it would cut down on federal spending. Absolutely. But I think Dan's getting a little testy here because we haven't really talked about the environmental issues.
I'm testy.
The other green issues.
So let's start off with Texas. Even though we weeks have gone by since this happened, I think this is a great example of something that is set up as a free market paradise.
Remember the Alamo.
Right. So Texas experienced frigid temperatures for a few days, and their power grid was not set up to handle it. But another aspect of their power grid was that they decided as a state to remain completely deregulated and completely disconnected from the national power grid. And as a result, those free market forces, once demand shot up and supply went way down, you had individuals with bills that were tens of thousands of dollars for a couple days use of power. And you know, that's just unconscionable when you think of a family that is cash strapped, is dealing with, you know, none of those houses, none of those, their infrastructure is not set up for winter. So they had to jack up their electric heat, for instance, or any number of things. The grid fell apart, but it was structured in a way that was designed to discourage use by being extremely expensive. But it happened so immediately that people didn't know or didn't have a choice. And it's just, it boggles my mind that someone can sit around and defend that type of power grid.
Well, and it's sold by the benefit of, oh, you're paying wholesale prices and you'll pay the lowest price. And, you know, that's based on average usage. And, you know, to tie it back to the environmental stuff, as this climate change stuff goes out of control, Texas is going to see more and more wild swings like this. And their grid can't handle that sort of load, obviously. You know, they don't have enough overhead to make sure that it does, or they don't have the incentive, or the incentive exists in the other direction. Like, this is only going to get worse if it's not really addressed.
But you know what's wild too is Texas, my understanding is Texas's system is fully independent, but you've got all kinds of other states, you know, like say an Oklahoma or a Tennessee, which may or may not have had tons of excess power. But Texas, being the rebels that they are, they don't want to be interconnected. And I feel like with this big infrastructure bill that we're going to talk about in a minute, there's an opportunity to be able to share power resources in a way that, because the grid isn't, my understanding of this, the grid on a national scale is not a smart grid.
Right, but the disconnection, the fact that they're disconnected from the national power grid was what allowed them to have a deregulated market. So it was by design that it was disconnected. And you're absolutely right, Dan. If they had been connected, they could have just, you know, borrowed some power from another state. It's crazy. And Ali Dulcimer will talk about the fact that it just makes so much more sense for, you know, your power companies to be nationalized, or at least for us to remove some of the influence that they have over elected leaders. But Dan, you have been kind of excited about this infrastructure bill. I think we heard Infrastructure Week every other week during the Trump administration. But finally, what's going on with this bill?
So right now, it looks to be between $2 and $3 trillion total price tag. But it looks like Biden is tying his entire climate agenda to it. So rather than being like the tree-hugging liberals who are like, you know, I use Nalgene and I shop at Patagonia, like this is actual infrastructure. So it looks like $400 billion is in there to combat climate change. $60 billion for green transit. They want to build power charging stations for electric vehicles all across the Eisenhower Highway System. And then just all kinds of individualized stuff. He set the goal of decarbonizing the United States electric system by 2035. But in addition to doing that sort of macro stuff, building all of these interconnected systems, talking about amping up and extending tax credits. So as someone who bought solar panels in 2019, and between the state of Massachusetts and the feds, I think I'm getting back a little over 20,000 in credits. So that's 100% the reason I did it. So I think, of course, the infrastructure bill needs to be big in scale and be in all 50 states. But I think if you give individuals really big incentives, people see this shift happening. The Dems are for once going with the grain instead of against it.
Well, and so when you name all those things, you know, that are in this bill as they're drawing it up, you know, it sounds like Democrats are finally doing what I've wanted them to do for a very long time, which is start negotiations from a place of strength. Start from, you know, make some really strong demand. Don't start with your compromise.
Well, you know what your problem was, Pat, is you've been busy like building a family and a career, and you didn't start this pod in time. So that's why they didn't know. They were not aware.
That's it. Speaking of this pod, C-Money, you've uncovered some evidence that trickle-down economics is finally dead. Is that right?
Yeah, well, there was a speech Joe Biden gave in the Rose Garden the other day where he declared trickle-down economics to be dead. You know, just as I join up with you guys and start hanging out with you guys, he declares it over. And then on top of that, I was listening to Democracy Now! That same day, and I heard Joe Stiglitz, for anybody who doesn't know, he's a Nobel Prize-winning economist. He was chief economist at the World Bank. He's written some really great books about neoliberal global finance and all of its attendant effects, stuff like that. But he came out on Democracy Now! And also declared trickle-down economics to be dead, which I just thought it was funny to hear those two say it on the same day, because Joe Stiglitz has been saying that stuff forever. And Joe Biden has been kind of fastidiously avoiding that issue forever. So it's funny to hear him turn around and say that.
I actually found a direct quote from Biden. It said, and I quote, this is a direct quote from the president, trickle down capitalism is going to catch these hands. That's what he said. And well, he's a fighter. He's from Scranton. I don't know if you guys knew that.
He was going to behind the gymnasium, right, and have some type of fisticuffs back there.
Listen, but you Jack.
See, Money, don't worry. Even if trickle-down economics dies, rest in peace, trickle-down economics, Reaganomics will be worthy of ridicule for centuries. So,
yes, long live the Laffer curve.
Who's coming on the show today, Patrick? You said Ali Dulcimer from Virginia?
Yep, so she's running in Virginia's 11th district, which is Northern Virginia, Fairfax, that area. And she has a really interesting background. She worked for 30 years for DOD, Department of Defense, actually, but in environmental role. So DOD has tons of land under their control in the U.S., and her job was to make sure that that land was taken care of in an environmentally friendly way. So making sure that migratory bird patterns were not disrupted and that the land was managed, you know, as cleanly as possible. And so she finally was fed up enough with Jerry Conley, a Democrat, a centrist Dem who has taken a lot of money from corporate interests. And she just, you know, her son, who's I think in his late teens, just kind of pushed her and said, you know, this is it. You gotta run. This is your chance. And so she had a lot of really interesting things to say, and she taught me a lot about the environment. Our guest on this episode is Ali Dulcimer, who is running for Congress in Virginia's 11th District. Ali, welcome to Trickle Down Socialism. Could you introduce yourself to our listeners and explain what prompted you to run for Congress?
Sure, absolutely. Thank you so much, Pat. I really appreciate being here and having this opportunity. Briefly, I'm a person who has spent 3 decades working in the environmental field. You can look for details on my website for background, but basically, I'm someone who lost her husband to cancer and had to watch that whole process and deal with the healthcare industry and realize that having a profit motive in healthcare perverted the system. I'm someone who has 2 kids. And I have volunteered in their schools pretty much the entire time that they were doing it, except for the last couple of years when my husband was ill, and really saw the disparities in who was able to have preschool and who wasn't, and who learned recently that your education between the years of 3 and 8 is the single best predictor. Your zip code is the single best predictor for, you know, college versus jail. And someone who's worked in the environmental field, like I said, and watched the Trump administration like roll back the Endangered Species Act and the Migratory Bird Treaty Act and, you know, pollution standards and everything, and just watched all of that happen. And so I'm someone who's been active in the community, who's been passionate and who cares. I lost my job. There was a Trump appointee who eliminated my position as DOD's natural resources manager because the reason they gave was that the Department of Defense didn't have sufficient funds to support my position, you know, because DOD's on a shoestring budget.
Right.
Exactly. And then the final straw that got me to actually run, and it had been building up throughout the summer of 2020 with COVID really showing the economic disparities and the social inequities and the Black Lives Matter movement and everything that was happening, was watching a newscast. And I've talked about this, but it was watching the evening news and hearing that Jerry Conley, who is the current representative in my district, which is Fairfax and Prince William counties here in Northern Virginia, that he was holding up the HEROES Act so that he could add $3 billion in funding to support military contractors. And at the time, we all thought that money was going to be helping all the people who were, you know, losing their homes, waiting in line for food, all the rest of it. We subsequently learned 75% of it was corporate pork, but we didn't know that then. And I was appalled. And that was it. That was the final straw. And I looked at my son. He was the one who really wanted me to run. And I said, that's it. I'm done. We're running. And so that's how it happened. It was just too much. Couldn't take anymore. I had to be the change I wanted to see.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to hear that you made the choice to run. And I'm really excited to have you on because we have done a lot of shows already in the year that we've been on air, and we still have not covered the environment and climate change. And I really feel like that's kind of a gaping hole in what we've done so far. So because of your background, I wanted this interview to be centered around climate change and the environment. But there are a few things I just can't avoid when I, you know, talk to a candidate for office. First, just like maybe run through your top priorities that you care about, things that you're going to keep up front when you get to the House of Representatives.
Yes, thanks. So I'm not sure I can do three. So the first thing really is universal healthcare, right? But with Representative Jayapal having put in that bill, you know, I'm hoping that that won't have to be a priority when I get there. I'm hoping that it will have been done. It's unlikely because of the corporate forces against it, but that is a huge, huge priority. And, you know, I can talk about that more later. Aggressive climate action. My opponent has signed on to the Green New Deal along with, I think, 300 other representatives. But Virginia has a Green New Deal Act, which actually implements Green New Deal actions here in Virginia. And he not only has never endorsed it, he's never even acknowledged it exists. So I think signing resolutions is all well and good, but where you need to look at, you know, where the rubber meets the road is how you actually vote and what you're willing to stick your neck out for. And aggressive climate. We've missed the window, right? We've missed the window to reverse climate change. It's gone. It's gone forever. All we can do now is hope to, you know, ideally stop it or slow it and try to adapt, because that's where we are. And I started off with education when I spoke earlier, and that's a huge, huge issue for me. I love progressives when they talk about, yes, we need free college, free trade schools. That's great. But you know, the reality is that a lot of kids never get there. They never get there because they have to drop out, because they have to work, because they have to care for sick family members, because of whatever, because they've ended up in that school to prison pipeline. There are so many issues. So for me, quality preschool education is huge. Right now, the average preschool teacher for like Head Start, the average salary is like $17,000 a year and is a high school graduate. That's not high quality education. That's underserving people who are already underserved. So that's huge. That's huge. And then women's rights in this district, in this particular district, single women are the three most economically disadvantaged groups, the 18 to 24, 25 to 34, and 35 to 44. And I'm a single woman. I was raised by a single mom. And she did not earn a dollar for her work that her male counterparts earned. And we dealt with that. And to think that that's still going on. And yes, the pay equities have improved, at least for some women, not for all women, but that's a huge issue. But the ultimate goal would be to get corporate funding out of politics. Because I really think that if we can get a plurality of true progressives who aren't being bribed, for lack of a better word, that might be too harsh, but who aren't being funded, let's say that, who aren't being funded by corporate interests, a lot of these things are going to fall into place. So, I mean, look at, you know, any current legislation and where it dies or how it fails or what the compromises are. And if you actually took corporate interests out of that, that would look so much different. So, you know, my priorities might be environment and healthcare and education and workers' rights and women's rights. I mean, workers' rights in Virginia are just not good. But all of that is underlaid by this foundation of a perverted corporate influence. So I can't do three, but that's where I'm at.
Well, thank you for that. I agree that it all boils down to the corporate influence. And I don't think bribery is too strong of a word. It's just legalized because of the system we have now. So one last question, and you kind of touched on this, but doing research for this interview, I was shocked when I found out that Virginia is rated the worst state out of 50 for workers' rights. You have Democratic majorities now. Like, how did this happen? What's going on?
Part of me thinks that it's a combination of factors. And one is Virginia was a slave state. We had a few rich landowners, you know, lots of tobacco, lots of cotton, right? That's our legacy. That's our history. And lots of slaves who then became tenant farmers. And, you know, there was a lot more in common between white and black tenant farmers than there was between the landed and the unpropertied. Right. And I think that there's a legacy of that. And I think that there's a holdover of that. So there's complaints, complacency, change is hard. No one wants to change. It's working for the wealthy, right? And then you have things like, you know, we talk about the corporate influence. You have corporations who are perpetuating a system where the businesses have all the rights and the workers do not, right? So you look at my opponent, Jerry Connolly, he gets 90% of his money from corporate interests and from mega donors. And then you have Terry McAuliffe, so 2021, Virginia and New York have gubernatorial races. So in Virginia, we currently have a gubernatorial race, and we have like this slate of, to varying degrees, really good progressive candidates running. And funding-wise, they're all being completely dwarfed by Terry McAuliffe, who is this institutional, corporate, everybody loves him favorite. He currently has $21 million in his bank account who can compete with that, right? You can't compete with that. And then you have somebody like Dick Saslaw, his biggest donor is Dominion Power, who wants to keep, you know, that's not a workers' rights group, right? And so they want to bring in Amazon and they want to bring in all these big businesses. And these big businesses are great for big business, but not for workers. So I think that's how it happens. It's a combination of our history and of the legacy of wealthy people being in bed with corporate interests.
As a history teacher, I love the fact that you connected that to history, and I don't think that history can be ignored. So you support the Green New Deal. This point, I think it's often used just as a litmus test for progressive candidates. And I think since it was originally introduced, the understanding of what's in that legislation has kind of slipped a little bit among the general public. What do you find most appealing about the Green New Deal?
So the Green New Deal is at its core a new deal. It's a jobs bill. It's an economic stimulus bill, but it combines that with the fact that we are facing a climate crisis. Like we literally are at a point where 5 million acres are burning in the West, right? Not right now, but they were. And huge glaciers are falling off of ice sheets. And it's just, all you have to do is look at the news, right? So it's a jobs bill, which especially during COVID time is hugely important, but it's one that looks to the future instead of looking at the old paradigms of where you would get jobs through, say, the oil and gas industry. It's looking at creating jobs through a green lens, through an environmentally sustainable lens. And that means building infrastructure. It means transportation. It means finding sustainable energy sources and clean technology. It means electric vehicles. It means all kinds of things, right? That Green New Deal means a fair and equitable way to do it, because one of the things that underlies so much in terms of climate is also environmental injustice and the inequities, because coal-fired power plants are never in the super affluent areas. There's no coal-fired power plant in, say, Great Falls here or in Georgetown. You know, where are they? They're in poor, predominantly brown and black neighborhoods in rural areas. So environmental justice is also a huge part of that. And it's basically a comprehensive way to address inequities, climate crisis, jobs. It provides for training. It's a very multi-pronged thing. I will say I wish it did a little more with sustainable farming. I think that the loss of our topsoil is really not being appreciated. You know, we don't need another Dust Bowl. And these mega farmers that have these huge monocultures. Monocultures is like the antithesis of biodiversity, right? Like you don't want monocultures. You have all this money through the farm bill. I'm getting off topic, but you have all this money, you know, through the farm bill going to corn and soy and wheat, basically. And sugar comes in there as well. And then what you have is all these economic incentives, and they're basically out competing on a cost basis, these small, sustainable, and especially organic farmers. And we saw that, for instance, with this recent push in Virginia with marijuana legislation. You know, it ended up not being exactly as good as it should have been. But, you know, I get that. The incrementalist, whatever, I don't know. I don't believe in incremental, really, not when you're at this stage. But basically, the Green New Deal is a comprehensive way to create jobs, save the environment, introduce equity into our system, into our social and justice systems. And if you want to look at a great model, I would encourage everybody to look at the Virginia Green New Deal Act.
I'd like you to kind of flesh out what you said about, you know, you wish the Green New Deal did more in terms of sustainable farming. What are the consequences there and what's going on?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And I'm not an agrarian and I'm not a soil expert. But the reality is that because of climate change impacts, weirding of weather phenomenon, more droughts, more floods in our farming areas in the heartland, and with the growth and subsidization of mega agro farming, like the big corporation farmings, you have a lack of replacement of nutrients into the soil, and you have kind of a short-sighted way of looking at things. And it's global as well. I mean, it happens when you strip down the rainforest so that you can plant huge monoculture coffee plantations, and the land becomes depleted. And so you need more land. And if we could focus more and subsidize more the smaller, more sustainable farming practices, we could keep our topsoil basically becoming depleted and is blowing away, right? And so if you look at some of the estimates, I read something a while ago, and it was something like in the next 40 to 60 years, we're going to have a soil crisis. We're not going to have this rich, growth-ready soils that we need for our food. And so we need to start really focusing on sustainable farming practices, not just here in the U.S., but globally. You know, you can't just keep cutting down huge swaths of the rainforest for cattle farming and coffee growing and expect not to have consequences from that. And we're already seeing consequences from that. You know, we're seeing more diseases and we're seeing more storms and we're seeing, you know, all these other things that are happening. And it's all interrelated. Like you overfish and overfish and overfish in the oceans. And sure, there's plenty of fish. And then all of a sudden, boom, there's no fish. And that's what's happening with farmlands as well as other systems. And you have to pay attention early on because an ounce of prevention really is worth a pound of cure.
So you kind of talked about this when you talked about incrementalism and where we actually are with the climate. But if we can't pass the Green New Deal at the federal level as it's written, do you support passing parts of it, but not all of it?
Yes. I mean, yes. You know, this gets back to the argument that the dozen progressives in Congress aren't doing enough. Yeah, okay, they're not doing enough. There's only 12 of them, you know, but they're doing something. And yes, so I mean, you do what you can. Ideally, we can get a bunch of genuinely progressive, not corporately funded candidates elected, and then we don't have to do this. We can actually make bold change. So it really is up to the will of the people to stop being afraid of switching to more progressive candidates and paying. And, you know, they don't pay any attention to the data, which actually shows. I mean, you look at Jamie Harrison's race, right? They threw how much into that race? The money in that race was horrible. And the reality is he's a corporate Dem. And he's the reason we got that kind of candidate. He's the reason we got the reaction that led to Trump. Trump is a symptom of the corporate mindset that is within the Blue Dog Democratic Party. And it's up to the will of the people to just take a leap of faith, man, and go with it.
I like that. On another recent episode, one guest talked about performative wokeness. This was Mayor Bird, in terms of renaming buildings and stadiums that are named after racists and other problematic figures, but not actually changing the structural problems underneath. It seems like your opponent Connolly practices this performative wokeness from what I've seen, but I think it's often done by centrists when it comes to the environment and climate change. And, you know, it's also done with healthcare we've seen. But where have you seen performative environmentalism from your opponent or from any other centrist Democrats?
Well, the easiest example is that my opponent signed the Green New Deal resolution and hasn't paid any attention to the Green New Deal Act, which actually implements Green New Deal tenants, jobs, training, electric vehicles, you know, all these things. In fact, electric vehicles, there were 5 electric vehicle bills in our House and they died in our Senate because you have people like Dick Saslaw and you have Eileen Filler-Corn. And so I think the only thing that ended up coming out of that whole slate of bills that was introduced in the House side was the clean air out of tailpipe. That's the only one that I've seen that came out. And yet every single one of them talks about, I am a progressive, I am an environmentalist, I blah, 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 and we need to do this. But then they don't do it. And why don't they do it? Because here in Virginia, Dominion Power is hugely, hugely influential in politics. They are a regulated public service that earns incredible profits. And that phrase alone should cause everybody heartburn. There's just so much wrong there. And the reality is that no matter where you are, if you have a representative who talks in one way and votes in a different way, that's where the problem is. So, for instance, with incrementalism, it's not just in the environment, it's not just in healthcare. I think it's a way, it's almost like a bait and switch to try and get you to pay attention to something else. So Connolly has recently gone on this thing about we need to rename the FBI building because J. Edgar Hoover was, you know, anti-gay. It was during this whole LGBTQIA thing. And so he's like, yes, 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 because that's the issue of the moment I'm going to pay attention to. But, you know, he hasn't actually, I mean, that's great, but he hasn't done anything to help LGBTQIA right. So, you know, where's the equity? Where's the substantive stuff? But I was listening to Eileen Filler-Corn talk about how they had taken down statues in Richmond because we care about Black and brown people. And she's going on and on. And, you know, people are applauding, right? They're doing the little hand clap thing in our Zoom meeting. And I put into the chat, I was like, yeah, that's great. And I'm so glad they're doing that important work. But what about the economic... What about the economic side of it? What about creating equal opportunities for Black and brown people? What about trying to get more healthcare? What about improving education? What about anything of substance? And, you know, then all these people are kind of, they didn't think about it, right? They're like looking at my little thing in the chat. And I think that it's just, it's smoke and mirrors, you know? It's like Trump was a master at it.
Sure. What kind of data have you seen on the environmental impact of COVID? So when lockdowns first started, I saw a lot of coverage on the positive impact that lockdown was having. You know, animals were coming out into neighborhoods. There were fewer cars on the road, less CO2 in the air, et cetera. But more recently, I've seen some reporting that the benefits are actually quite negligible. What do you know about how much COVID has impacted environmental concerns?
Yeah. So here's the thing, right? I'm going to use an analogy. When I first had my son, being the green, environmentally friendly, rah-rah person, I decided I'm not using disposable diapers. I'm going to use cloth diapers, which was a nightmare because, you know, he was up every 90 minutes. And not only that, but I found out that between the hot water and the bleach that's used to actually clean those cloth diapers, there's no benefit. It's equal to using disposables. It's just where you impact. Where's the bubble when you squeeze the balloon, basically? Right, right. And I think that's the way it is with the COVID impacts on the environment. There's definitely less air pollution. There's less flying. There's less driving. We have less air pollution. But guess what? We have a lot more people who are poaching endangered species because that's just happening. We have a lot more rainforest being cleared for food production. And we have more pollution in general. People are polluting more. Right? They're throwing away stuff. And the mask situation, you think like, oh, a mask, what, oh, that's not a big deal. No, no, no. That's like saying a drop of water is not a big deal. But what happens if you have a bazillion drops of water? You have a deluge. And that's what's happening with masks, right? So you have, I mean, just that one impact alone has had a huge negative impact.
You mean when masks are thrown away, right? Just as
they're thrown away, they're improperly disposed, they're not cutting the loops, they're ending up in the oceans, they're ending up blowing away in the wind, they're ending up strangling wildlife. Life. I mean, it's actually a very real thing. Mm-hmm. When you think about impacts from COVID in terms of the environment, it's a squeezing the balloon thing.
Another part of this is thinking of cause and effect and that environmental destruction. I've read some that it causes or it. They can't prove causation, but that there's some correlation between destroying the environment and the increase of pathogens and pandemics like COVID. Do you know anything about that connection?
I am not an expert in this. However, when I worked at DOD, I worked closely with my counterpart at the Armed Forces Pest Management Board, looking at diseases and pathogens and viruses. And we had things like Zika and H1N1 and everything else. And the reality is, and this is just a reality, that as we have continued to negatively impact our environment, and especially with climate, the climate beginning to really change, like it's becoming an exponential output for climate change, you're going to see a lot more of these things. There is a very direct relationship between the ability of viruses to spread and survive and the destruction of natural habitats and the breaking down of natural barriers. And so things, for example, for folks who don't know, an invasive species is one that is in a place where it is not native and is destructive to other flora or fauna. So you look at killer bees. Now, they're Africanized killer bees in the plains of the Serengeti. Not a big deal. Not a lot of people there. But so they ended up in Texas. And we thought, okay, fine. They're stuck in Texas along with red imported fire ants, right? No, no, no. Guess what? As we have continued to warm our temperatures, and as the any sort of natural boundaries or barriers or species that would have helped control those things have become overwhelmed, they've spread and spread and spread. And so you're going to have diseases and pathogens and all kinds of things when the systems break down. I talked earlier about the web of life. It's all interrelated, and you're not going to be able to separate those things out at all.
That makes a lot of sense. And you really kind of made that link clear for me. I hadn't made sense of that before. So speaking of COVID, I teach in Boston, and the population of kids I teach is a population that has suffered disproportionately from the virus, not just their family members that are adults, but kids, Black and brown kids, are 8 times more likely to suffer from severe COVID or die of it. I'd imagine this is likely due to the far higher rate of comorbidities like asthma. And that, I think, is often attributed to the poor air quality in their neighborhoods. And the buildings, you know, many of them live in are also not, you know, really up to code, and, you know, they don't clean the air the way they should. What do you think can and should be done on the intersectionality of racial and environmental justice?
Yeah, thanks. That's a really excellent question. It's also incredibly complicated. So, intersectionality is a huge issue. And for folks not familiar with it, it basically means if you think about a neighborhood and you have your intersections, it's where different issues cross and then can affect each other. So when you're looking at something like the Green New Deal, that's why it's looking at not just the environment, but it's also looking at training and equity and education and all these other things, because the reason that one of the reasons COVID is having such a disproportionately significant impact is exactly what you said about underlying asthma or other things. But that's because coal-fired power plants are being built there. That's because there's oil refineries being built there. It's because their education system is not good. And many people really, especially early on, didn't understand the link between wearing masks or properly wearing masks, or they don't have the resources because they're economically disadvantaged. Or whatever the issues are, it's absolutely all interrelated. In addition to which, here's another thing. Food is kind of a big deal for me, so I'm coming back to it. But in these, especially in sort of urban, disadvantaged urban areas, you have food deserts. And food deserts are where you basically don't have a grocery store. So kids can't get fresh fruits and vegetables, let alone organic. They can't even get fresh fruits and vegetables. They eat basically out of the 7-Eleven, packaged foods, canned goods, whatever. Highly processed foods. And globally, it's something like 70% of premature deaths are caused by ingestion of ultra processed foods, like a diet that is consistently ultra high processed foods. Well, that is an environmental issue. It's an economic injustice issue. There's so much there. It's a racial issue. And those people who are, you know, in these food deserts, who are living in homes that maybe still have asbestos or lead in the paint or whatever, or have pipes that are horrible. I mean, look at what happened in Jackson, Mississippi right now with the water, right? You know, these people are going to have significantly disproportionate impacts and results from a COVID exposure. And so it's all interrelated. We need universal healthcare. We need clean technologies. We have got to focus on early education, and we have got to have economic equity to level the playing field for all people.
So we talk a lot on this show on how the media is biased in favor of corporations. That bias played out against Senator Sanders in 2016 and 2020, just as one example. Does this bias also affect how the media covers climate change and environmental destruction?
Well, sure, of course, because the media, everything the media reports is affected by its corporate donor base. Back in the 70s, there were dozens of news outlets that were all independently owned. And now the vast majority of news outlets are all owned by five big companies. And you have a few independent ones out there, but they're struggling, like yourself. You don't have corporate backing.
Nope.
So, it's you're able to tell the truth. But the reality is that all of the major networks are corporately owned, and they're owned by a very slim number. And it's not just that they're distorting the news to support their political or corporate bends, like Fox saying the Green New Deal is going to be the biggest jobs killer ever. It's going to devastate business. It's going to put everybody out of business and have a whole new, you know, it's 1929 all over again. Or MSNBC saying it's, you know, great, but, you know, we have to make sure we do it slowly. But both of those are corporate influenced. I read an article in The Guardian. It's been a couple of years now, but it stuck with me. And the basic premise of the article is that the news media, especially in the US, is skewed. And it's not just because of this corporate bias, but the corporate influence of needing to be profitable. So they were the article, and I don't remember the specifics, but the article talked about how the need for ratings, which drives advertisers, which brings money, skews reporting. And the example that stuck in my brain was that in 2018, the IPCC, the International Panel on Climate Change, IPCC, released their big report, right? That was 2018, the big report. Here's climate change. And only 22 of the 50 major news outlets in the U.S. even covered the story. Why? Because there is no profit in a public good. There is no economic incentive for an advertiser to support that story.
Right. And that's a depressing story. So people might tune out at that point, and that's not going to drive the ratings. Yeah, that's a good point. So I know you're a grassroots candidate, so it means you don't take any corporate campaign funding. And I think you've done that from the outset. And we've talked about corporate influence on politics. But I also know that your opponent does not. I even saw that he takes a lot of money from military contractors. Corporate special interests is, as we've talked about already in this interview, the biggest barrier to meaningful reform on so many fronts. But how does it connect to our current situation from the perspective of climate change and destruction of the environment?
So how does corporate funding affect our current situation? I think the simplest answer to that is looking in Virginia, for me, is looking at Dominion Virginia Power, which talks a lot about how they're the leader in clean environmental power, and they are doing solar, and they are doing this, when in fact, that's such a small sliver of what they're doing, and they are funding to the tune of hundreds of thousands of dollars, probably millions over time. They've given $500,000 to Dick Saslaw, for instance, and he has managed in the Senate, because he's leader of the Senate. He's been there since 1980, by the way, just to put that in perspective for everybody to think about when they were born. He single-handedly has killed nearly every single piece of environmental legislation out there. So it goes back to what I said early on in this interview, which is what they say and what they do. We need to look at that, right? And so in terms of climate change and energy, I think we just need to hold elected officials accountable, and we need to shine a light on these backroom deals, because the reality is that corporate funding, and I've said this before, corporate funding perverts outcomes. It skews them. And Dominion Virginia Power may say that they're the best environmental leaders ever, but the reality is they're trying to make a profit, and they're making a profit by pushing oil and gas and coal.
Good. I like that answer. That really sums it up and makes that link clear. One of the bright spots, in my estimation, of the Biden administration so far is the appointment of Deb Haaland, an Indigenous woman, to the Interior Department. I think she's already influenced Biden's decision, I can't confirm this, but to shut down the Keystone XL pipeline. I also think she'll take really seriously issues like the extinction of species. For instance, the Nez Perce is a Native American tribe that relies on the salmon runs in the Idaho region where they live. And those salmon are on the brink of extinction. What can be done and should be done and might be done now that we have Secretary Deb Haaland running the Department of the Interior?
Yeah, thanks for that question. That was such an awesome appointment. Really, really awesome, and far past time. And there's so much that can be done in that position. And I hope that she's able to get I know she's going to try to do everything she can. And I hope that it's able to go forward. So I worked closely with Department of Interior. I was actually housed in Department of Interior in my first job when I worked at the Fish and Wildlife Foundation, which was actually created as a way to combined public-private funding out of the Fish and Wildlife Service for high-priority conservation efforts. So there's a couple things. First of all, Native Americans and Indigenous people in general have an awesome ethic where natural and cultural are the same, right? Because natural resources and cultural resources are all part of our heritage. And it has been atrocious how cultural resources have been devastated in this nation. And not just this nation, there was the Aboriginal cave that was something like 3,000, 2,000 years old. And some mining group went in and freaking blew it up for ore. That was outrageous. It's gone forever. So I think she can bring that more holistic view of our natural environment to be both natural and cultural, which means hopefully she'll finally start being able to fund the Park Service, which has been chronically underfunded for decades, just ridiculously so. And hopefully we can start calling, instead of the Bureau of Land Management, which I got to tell you, those of us in the environmental world, we call it the Bureau of Leasing and Mining, because there are cost loss, meaning the U.S. government loses money by leasing mineral and mining rights to private investors and then never gets anything back for it. It's atrocious, absolutely atrocious. And so maybe start doing that. Start rebuilding the Endangered Species Act, which, you know, to recover a species is a 30 to 50, sometimes 70 year horizon. Well, we're reaching that point, right? We're starting to recover species, and to cut funding, with Trump cutting funding, oh my God, that was just such a huge setback. And hopefully even more, can we start funding efforts to prevent species from becoming listed. You know, keeping common species common, funding species at risk efforts. I personally would like to see us start to manage on an eco-regional basis, because these geopolitical boundaries that people have set up, you know, an animal doesn't recognize where Georgia is and where South Carolina is, right? So that's a stupid way to manage things. And the wall in Texas just literally cut Sonoran pronghorn habitat in half, and they're already critically endangered. And also, I'd really like to see on the invasive species front, there's not enough talk about this, but I'd like to see red rules. Right now, what we have are green rules, where you can bring in whatever you want, and oh my gosh, it's invasive, it's devastating, let's stop bringing it in. That's just stupid. Australia says, you know what, you have to prove that this is not going to be invasive before you are allowed to bring it in. That's the way we need to approach our imports. So those are just a few things off the top of my head that I would love to see her do.
Those are great. Australia, I think, has come around to that, but they have their own, you know, sordid history of bringing in like the cane toad and then finding out it didn't come out at the same time of day as the cane beetle. But so many of the people who listen to this show, I would think, have been acutely aware of how bad things are in terms of the progression of climate change. And they might worry that it's too late to make enough changes to heal our planet or to stop or slow the effects of global climate change. Could you help us kind of end on a hopeful note and help us understand why we should fight and take action?
Yes, absolutely. Because the reality is there are simple things everybody can do every day that make huge differences collectively. First of all, in terms of federal action, for every dollar that's invested in restoration, there's a tenfold return on investment. So we need to really start looking at restoring systems. And not just in this country. Our government is rich, relatively speaking. We can help other countries. Look at Brazil, right? We can help other countries invest in restoration, in ecotourism, these kind of things. We can start funding in clean technology, getting away from oil and gas, you know, through the Green New Deal and other excellent technologies. We can take the reusable bag to the grocery store, drink from a reusable bottle. We can, you know what you can do? This is not popular with a lot of people, but meat consumption is hugely devastating to the environment. And I could actually probably talk for an entire hour on that alone. But, you know, one statistic that I saw was if you give up using paper for a year, you save 8.5 trees, which is stupid because paper is grown on farms that are sustainable. Whereas beef is, you know, you tear down the rainforest for it, right? But if you give up beef for a year, you save 3,500 trees. And you can save more water by not eating 1 pound of beef, so skipping one beef meal, than you would from not showering for 6 months, right? So, you know, these things, I mean, it depends how long you shower, I guess. But, you know, the reality is there are such simple things that we can all do. We can start taking our plastic bags if we have them to the proper recycling. We can cut the tags off our masks. We cannot use, you know, we cannot release Mylar balloons into the air that then get ingested by sea turtles. I mean, these just simple, simple things. You can create pollinator habitat just by planting some things in a window box or in a garden. You can buy sustainable. You can buy organic. You can, there's so many little ways, and it all depends on how much will and energy you have, but even little things like recycling properly make a huge difference.
Great. I like those. That's shocking to me. I do enjoy eating meat, and to hear that it could have that much of an impact to give up beef is mind blowing. So the way I see it, based on some research that I've done, it seems like you've got a good opportunity here to win this seat. So the last primary challenger Conley faced, I think she raised less than $30,000 and still was able to win 25% of the primary vote. How do you see this race, you know, shaping up, and are you feeling hopeful about your chances against Conley?
Yeah, thanks for that question. Yes, absolutely. I think Zainab Mohsini, who ran, she got about 23% of the vote. People are ready for a change. She had almost no name exposure. And I will tell you that since Connolly has found out about our race, he has signed on to over 30 pieces of progressive legislation that he has never paid any attention to before. So he knows we're here. He knows it's real, and he's trying to appear more progressive. But unfortunately, like I said, he signs these resolutions and doesn't actually vote to implement anything. But people, you know, here's the thing. If you care about healthcare, everybody being cared for, if you care about our planet being able to survive, if you care about our children being able to grow up without asthma and other diseases, if you care about education, if you care about just common sense things, if you want to save money, if you're a small business owner and you want to stop paying 33 cents of every dollar to the healthcare industry for corporate profits, then you're ready for a change and you want it. And people are ready for a change. They want that change. And I think we have a very good chance. Our biggest barrier is that people don't know us. Everybody knows Jerry because he's very well funded. We have no money and he's got huge name recognition. We're brand new. So yes, you know, and I'm going to put a shameless plug in. Go to our website, allyforcongress.com. You know, donate if you can, $5, $2, $100 if you got it, whatever. Volunteer if you can, share, like, tweet, whatever. Our biggest thing is we really want to get the word out that there is an alternative and that these, you know, people keep saying that I'm left or progressive or whatever. Fine. I don't care. Label me whatever you want. Call me Sam. I don't care. I think it's just common sense. It's common sense to save money, save the planet, do things. You know, in the 70s, everybody talked about all the environmental stuff that was coming out with the Environmental Protection Agency and the Endangered Species Act and the Clean Air Act, all these things, right? It's going to devastate business. It's going to be horrible, blah, blah, blah. It turned out companies ended up finding out that they were actually saving money. It created jobs. It was a win-win. You know, the Cuyahoga River stopped burning. People are very, they're set in their ways. Change is hard. I get that. But if you look at it, what I'm trying to put forth is just common sense. It just is. It's not radical.
Right. And I was about to ask you already covered it, but could you repeat your campaign website and your Twitter handle for folks who kind of want to get on board and support you however they can?
Yes. Thank you so much. Absolutely. It's Ally, A-L-L-Y, 4-F-O-R, congress.com. And my Twitter handle is Ally, the number 4, Congress. And so please join us, fund us if you can, volunteer if you can, share, like, etc. We need your help.
Well, thank you, Ally, so much for taking the time to do this. I learned a lot doing this interview. So I really appreciate you coming on to Trickle Down Socialism.
Well, thank you, Pat. I appreciate it. And if you'd like it to go into any other topics, I'm happy to do it in the future.
Sounds great.
Cool.
Dan, C-Money, what'd you think?
I did like her talking about jobs and the Green New Deal being tied together and like infrastructure and the Green New Deal being tied together and seeing, you know, the plan that Dan pointed out today. I've been kind of reading an article in the background about it and just how they're looking to open those jobs within green industries. I feel like she tied those points together really nicely. Like she drew a nice holistic picture of how all of that can work together to bring jobs, help the economy, and be environmentally friendly and build like a structurally sound, sustainable environmental future.
I was amazed at her depth of knowledge. And she actually told me going into it, she was like, I'm really nervous because I haven't done many podcast interviews and I listened to some of your previous episodes and your guests are just such experts in their fields. And then she talked and I was like, oh, wow, you know what you're talking about. So,
like a Liz Warren energy in a way, just the way Liz Warren talks about, like, you know, consumer finance protection and banking and stuff like that. She gave me that same sort of passion.
Yeah, I
like
good comparison. To
her talk. Yeah, the way that she's like excited about it in a genuine way. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, like she can go on at length about it. Yeah.
Right. But she was also talking, I like how she picked on people, like a shitload of people have signed on to the Green New Deal, but not the Green New Deal Act or whatever the mechanism is to implement it. And yeah. She she kept saying, she said like two or three times, look at what they do.
Yeah.
Which is so true, right? Because anyone could come out. It's kind of like the thoughts and prayers of legislation, right?
Yeah.
Where people come out and they're like, well, that was a nice rainforest. We need to stand up for the rainforest. And it's like, motherfucker, you could have stopped the rainforest from getting destroyed. Like, right. Don't come afterwards and talk about how bad it was. Like, right. Do something.
And I like the fact that when I asked her about environmental justice, especially having to do with people like my students, she had an answer ready to go. You know, we need to stop putting the types of things like power plants and other facilities right adjacent to those neighborhoods. And she offered, you know, some of what the Green New Deal is designed to do as a solution. But she had other ideas as well on how to, you know, stop putting black and brown people at such risk for health problems just because of where they live.
Well, and that's that kind of holistic look at environmental stuff through a social lens that I was talking about, where she combines like a look at environmental racism like that with, you know, also like aside from environmental stuff, she talked about the importance of early childhood education and development in terms of opportunity. And that kind of brings all of that together. So you can see she has some really big picture views and sees the importance of the environmental stuff within that.
So we've got a couple of things in the pipeline, Dan. We're going to talk to a group that's done some really cool things with food. Could you just give us a real quick rundown on what they do?
Yeah, so I actually came to know Rescuing Leftover Cuisine as a school counselor, because when the pandemic hit, I knew there were some families that would need some food. And as it turns out, Rescuing Leftover Cuisine, as their name would imply, rescues food. 40% of the United States food supply is wasted. And it's usually because of like our snobbery for, you know, really beautiful looking food or like the highest quality food that looks good on shelves. They're like an entire volunteer run organization. They started in New York City a little less than a decade ago, and they're expanding across the United States. And so it's a cool organization that'll be coming up soon. And you have some district attorneys that you're talking to?
Yeah, District Attorney Rachel Rollins, who is a woman of color and also one of the most progressive DAs in the country. She runs the DA's office for Suffolk County, which encompasses Boston. And, you know, she is so progressive that when she kind of set out in that job, she immediately caught flack from Charlie Baker and his administration for just the plan she had, the way she wanted to run that office. So that should be really fun to hear what she has to say now that she's had some time as the DA for Suffolk County.
Maybe C. Money Burns will come back and talk to us about it.
Maybe. Maybe if you're
not. He's not busy fighting the man.
And absolutely check out C. Money Burns. His link is going to be in the episode notes this time as well. You can check out his incredible music. From a poetic standpoint and from a, let's call it a gaze into socialism, but with a kind of an eclectic twist, I found it to be really fun to listen to.
Well, thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Well, thanks for tuning in, people. We'll see you again next time.
Yeah, thanks.
Thanks for listening to Trickle Down Socialism. If you liked what you heard, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. Also, we'd love to hear from you. If you have comments, questions, ideas for future topics that we should cover, please give us a call at 781-343-1813 and leave us a message. That's 781-343-1813. And remember to subscribe so you know exactly when our next episode drops. See you next time on Trickle Down Socialism.